a beaver sound. Are you familiar with our oeuvre?
So, Amanda, what's your oeuvre?
Well, Angelica, it's everything performance, darling. I'm particularly very passionate about standing in front of a group of people on a stage and speaking or singing very loudly. But my oeuvre comprises of the works of Arthur Miller, Sondheim, Villeneuve. But I'm very just excited about pretending to be someone I'm not for around 2 hours. But it's great, you know. I just directed a play at LSE. That was great. I've loved performing since I was a wee young child. And yeah, I love talking about theater. I love being in theater. And I love everything, the performance arts. What about you, Angelica? What would you say your oeuvre is?
I'm so glad you ended your note with something about performance. Because what if the performance isn't on stage, but it's in a place, or even a canvas? Now, I'd say that's my oeuvre. Mm. It's just think gallery crawls, essentially anything that pushes the boundaries of art. I recently went to the Long Now exhibition at the Saatchi Gallery, and I was particularly struck by how different artists were pushing the boundaries of art. Like, for instance, The Golden Lotus inverted by British artist Conrad Shawcross, or the sculpture 2050 by Richard Wilson, which was an entire room sort of flooded in oil waist up. And I remember talking to someone, and they said something that was quite striking, I think. And it was that the artwork backs the audience into a corner. This was about the 2050 sculpture. Mm-hmm. So for our listeners, it is quite literally an entire room flooded up to waist high in oil. And for those people who have a sense of smell, it's quite powerful, I'd say. I still can't get over the smell, to be honest. And we were just talking about how it backs the audience into a corner. And I was thinking, now that's my oeuvre. How do viewers respond to art? Like, is something like such a powerful smell central to the purpose of the artwork? Mm. And then sort of building on from that, I feel like it would be quite elitist if I were just to say that, you know, it's all about perception of the artwork, because how to talk about art is something that it's quite a privilege to say that you know how to do. Mm-hmm. And so if I had to summarise my oeuvre, it would be unpacking the language of art and how we talk about it and deconstructing sort of a hegemony that exists around art. Basically, just deciphering what the annoying hipster things to do with art are. What about you, Farah?
I am so glad you started on the topic of art, because I would say my oeuvre is wearable art. My oeuvre is clearing out every thrift store in East London, which, for the astute listener of Beaver Sound, you'll know that that's our topic for the day. But I was recently in Paris. I was quite the victim to all the sample sales, the thrift store stocking former runway pieces. I was roped into buying a sample never made again plain suit top that I then proceeded to wear to a murder mystery spy party, and I felt very good about the fact that no one there knew I was wearing an archival production sample. No one in this room knows that this was never made again. I'd say that's my oeuvre. My closet is full of things that have a 10-minute explanation behind them but look like a normal cardigan. My oeuvre is the wearable arts. I got to see a Rick Owens exhibit. I was extremely happy to look at just these massive puffer jackets and then read a placard saying Rick Owens thinks the puffer jacket is the downfall of society, and I'm fully with him on that. Apologies to the puffer jacket wearers around campus. I still have love for you, but we need to sort it out.
Mind you, I'm wearing a puffer jacket today. Same here.
Well, listen, guys. It's not too late to make the transition to natural fibers. It's not too late to find a peacoat on Vinted.
It's no longer what's happening in East London. It's what's happening with the weather that makes everyone switch to puffer jackets.
It's what exact week of the year do we all decide cute jackets are no longer feasible? But yeah. I'd say that's my oof.
Delicious.
Scrumptious.
Scrumptious, even. So, well, it's interesting you mention East London, Farah, because today we're talking about what the hell is going on in East London.
Now, I'd like to start off, well, I'd say we'd like to start off with a quick disclaimer for the listeners of Beaver Sound who, you know, not familiar with perhaps the more satirical approach that we're taking with it. We are very much aware that we are part of the problem and that we are only scratching the surface with the broader issue of gentrification in London and especially East London. So I'd say we're talking about what we see online, what we hear people say and do. We all got off the overground at Cambridge Heath, London Fields, Bethnal Green and Shoreditch High Street. And so I suppose we're focusing on the dominant, I guess, visual and aesthetic appeal of East London. Think about high-profile individuals like Charlie XCX, calling Ellie's in Dalston the Charlie XCX bar. So essentially a curated lifestyle to seem casual or like you're not trying.
Very brat, you would say.
So brat.
Brat summer never left. It just evolved.
But essentially, this rising popularity of East London raises questions and issues about gentrification, cultural appropriation that continually seems to be ignored, I'd say.
Very correct. And with that, we go on to the East London creative, the producers, the musicians, the vague DJ clubbers of them all.
The zine makers.
Absolutely. Who is this
creature?
East London creative, this creature, this amorphous being. There is a significant overlap in our thesis with the performative man. They often seem privately educated. Do they work? Are they employed? How do they afford such hedonistic activities day and night?
How does their rent cost that much? But I've never seen them go to work.
Who is this person? Are they actually a creative? Are they actually producing stuff? Or do they drink and dance and that's about it? Well, we're here to investigate. Let's first talk about the uniform of these people. What do we often see them wearing?
As we know, this is my area of expertise. I've done a lot of ethnographic research on the East London creative. The male in particular, but I've observed the East London creative female and the East London creative non-binary as well. I'd say there's more overlap in the East London non-binary and the East London male in the sense that they're typically wearing jorts, often Acne Studios, but there'll be a Carhartt cargo short at times, a thrifted leather jacket. But to be clear, thrifted does not equal reasonable price in this equation. They will have easily paid over £100 for it. And then they will excuse this by saying it is real leather, when you can find real leather jackets for £30 at many thrift store. And the footwear is like a defining aspect here.
Of course.
So you need tabis, Onitsuka Tigers. And specifically when you ask the East London creative, oh, what are those shoes? They're going to give you the full-on Japanese pronunciation of the Onitsuka Tiger. This is vitally important.
Whitest man you've ever seen, by the
way. Whitest man you've ever seen, mullet. Sunglasses with an odd shape, beanie.
Occasional Sydney moustache in there.
Yes.
Oh my goodness. Yes. A moustache that they really just need to shave off.
I think all of them have been watching, have been looking at paparazzi pictures of Paul Mescal.
Absolutely. I was just going to say, I mean, we're off the season now, but during summer, tiny, tiny, tiny little shorts.
Just the smallest shorts you've ever
seen. Smallest shorts you've ever seen, and they're bright pink.
You didn't know that they sold shorts in that length until you saw them.
I think the Paul Mescal lookalike competition came a little bit too naturally to some of them.
I think, you know, on an average day on Bethnal Green, you can spot about 25 Paul Mescal lookalikes. And now if they're new to the scene, they haven't got a pair of Onitsuka Tigers yet because they haven't gone to Japan and posted about it incessantly on social media. They'll have a pair of white New Balances. Absolutely crisp, brand new, They have never walked anywhere in them that would dispense any type of dirt or filth onto these shoes. They are sparkling new. We return to the beanie and the scarf combo in this weather. But now this is the vital part.
It has to be an arsenal.
It has to be some type of football scarf, some type of football beanie. Don't mind Angelica, she's got a bit of a thing
you
about Arsenal.
You can hear the distaste and disgust.
Yes, we know lifelong.
For our listeners who are Arsenal fans, I sincerely apologise. Please continue listening to our
she's
podcast.
She's not sorry.
I am an Arsenal fan, for the record, okay? We set aside our differences to be in this room.
Would you say then that the transition from summer to winter is much like the transition between a Paul Mescal variety to a Jacob Elordi variety?
Undoubtedly.
Yes.
But this is the vital thing about the scarf, is if it's not Arsenal, it's a like second division Dutch league team that they found on eBay and they liked the logo. Mm-hmm. And they've never watched an Eredivisie match. They don't particularly intend to, but they like repping it because it makes them look cultured.
Mm-hmm. And more importantly, they just love telling the person they're on a date with about their profound interest in non-league Dutch football.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
They'll be like, I went to the pub with the players. It just feels so good to support a grassroots movement. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the players did not want them at the pub. Mm-hmm. And I think an important aspect here of the appearance of the East London Creative, and this might arise more in the East London Creative woman, is thrifting. Everything is secondhand, which, like, we love sustainability. I'm wearing a pair of thrifted black leather boots now. Angelica and Amanda can confirm this.
Absolutely.
So not too much on the thrifting. But it is a vital part of the East London Creative's identity that nothing they own is bought new, bar their massive shopping binge in the aforementioned Japan trip.
Now, don't get me wrong, vintage sales are great, upcycling pieces, great, but I think it's quite sort of, you know, it's quite odd to think, and it's quite disturbing to think that, I'd say especially pre-COVID, and now for an article on this, read the Fashion Roundtable, that is what we read ahead of this as well, in part to prepare for this episode. But it's almost like it was frowned upon pre-COVID, but now a lot of people seem to be using the justification of sustainability and being anti-fast fashion, which are inherently very good ideas and very good morals to have, especially when it comes to thinking about where you source the items that you wear every day, sort of the things that you show off and you tell your friends, hey, look, this, do you like this new outfit that I'm wearing? It's inherently a really good thing, but it seems to be sort of extrapolated into sort of masking the upsurge of the aesthetic appeal that many people, especially from higher socioeconomic backgrounds, seem to be using to say, as Farah mentioned, spend over £100 on a thrifted leather jacket and then not even take it to a leather specialist, which they can afford to do, just to say, oh, it's got the thrifted smell to it. When actually something like thrifting and secondhand clothes shopping should be made widely accessible, because it's in its very nature to be able to help more people afford clothes and to keep themselves warm, for instance, when it's cold. But It just seems quite disturbing to see how it's sort of treated nowadays. I don't know if you guys would agree.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you walk down Brick Lane now, and let's not even touch on the fact that Brick Lane was the Bangla Cultural District of London. We'll get to that in a second, don't worry. But the curated vintage shops with the astronomical price tags,
they're
and
ridiculous.
I think we have all experienced this. Mm-hmm. You walk into Y2K Vintage, you pick up a top that is 100% polyester with like 3 beads on it, £60. And listen, I love a Shop Yachts, I love a Vivian's Vintage, but we need to acknowledge how these places affect the thrifting landscape and the prices that are kind of deemed acceptable, because we can all laugh at a Depop Y2K rare deadstock Hollister V-neck for £100. But I fear we are all contributing to the shops that have made this system of pricing okay. And these kind of fashionable curated shops as well have made thrifting a status symbol, because it's very different to go through an Oxfam or a Mind kind of just searching for something to wear than it is walking to this immensely fashionable curated space with matching decorations and really cool cashiers and whatnot selling archival vintage. And even chains like Rocket Vintage and Beyond Retro and things like that have contributed to this a bit. And it's not that these shops are evil, but they've had an effect. They've had a discernible effect.
For sure.
And when you're on a date with one of these well-dressed vintage shopping people, and you've gone out for the day, and, you know, you're looking to settle down, maybe grab a bite to eat, they are going to bring you to an East London restaurant.
And you know, when you sit down at that tiny, tiny table on those cold, cold metal chairs.
No tablecloth.
No backs to the chairs.
None at all. A waiter who does not care about you will come up to you and ask you,
Do you know how we do things around here?
It's in the art not to be synchronized when saying that.
These small plate restaurants, we have to talk about them. They're everywhere in East London. They're everywhere.
They're spreading.
They're somehow all the same restaurant with the same name.
And to use Farah's words, it's always either a people name or an adjective and a noun that are disparate. Now, Farah, could you please pitch us a hypothetical name?
We have become so familiar with these restaurants. We are able to pitch you an entirely new one with our own menu to spare and a name. Very real business proposal. Farah,
so real.
Please take it away.
And guys, I just want to add that I have been to Jolene, okay? Like, I've been to Brat. Like, we are not making fun of anyone who has participated in these activities. We are all guilty. We were initially meant to do field research at an East London restaurant, and we could get a reservation at any of them. So this is also partially a place of bitterness and
jealousy.
Jealousy, yeah.
Resentment.
From Gabrielle and Charlie XCX just walking into Smoke and Go and being like, give me a table. And we need to wait outside in the poor people queue. And also a really vital element that you'll see in our fake business proposal, our very real business proposal.
Exactly.
Is that it must be a fusion of six different cuisines that disrespect all of them.
Yeah.
Love fusion food, but, you know, at a point, we need to draw a line.
So it comes to a point.
I've made an effort to disrespect all our cultures in this menu. So this is our totally real business proposal for a restaurant in London Fields. Let's say maybe a 5-minute, 10-minute walk from the station, kind of Broadway Market sort of area.
It has to be at the corner of the road as well, I think.
Oh, yes.
It's hidden away.
Yeah. You cannot find it using City Mapper or Google Maps that easily, but see, you shouldn't need to.
It might be on Apple Maps.
But you shouldn't need to, because you just know. And if you don't know, then
it's got one little sign that's written in, like, Arial font that you can kind of
italics.
See once you turn your head.
Arial italics, I would say. So this is our restaurant, the Leafy Oof, Oof singular for Oof, Oofs. This is our joint business venture. So when you sit down and one of the three of us asks, do you know how we do things around here? Have you been here before? We'll hand you a hastily scrawled menu on a piece of A5 moleskin paper in the worst handwriting you've ever seen. And this is what it'll say. You can have some bone marrow butter with two slices of sourdough for £15. We don't top up the sourdough. That's just egregious. You're trying to run us out of business. You get some tuna crudo with cacio e pepe sauce and shaved Japanese yam. Shout out to Angelica. Shout out to Italy. That's £22. You could have some skewered aubergine with buttermilk garlic aioli, which is what we call our bottled Hidden Valley Ranch sauce, and that's £27. Some Nduja honey gluten-free dumplings, also for £27. And just to be clear, it's three skewers and four dumplings. You can have our vegan miso shakshuka, which is just a plate of tomato sauce, you know, as they do back home for me in Morocco. £27, and then you can pay us £10 to add a singular egg. A lamb doner croquettes with ashwagandha chimichurri for £30. And I know this is Amanda's favorite.
I'm shaking.
the vegan sambal flavored cheesecake with white chocolate mole sauce. £30.
Disgusting. Those words Shout should never Indonesia. Be in that order. Ever.
And the only drink available is orange wine. Also, nothing on the menu is actually properly vegan or vegetarian.
Mm-hmm. And I'd say for the sober or sober curious who attend our very real restaurant, you cannot drink orange wine. There is going to be sort of some fine print on the menu saying that there is also non-alcoholic orange wine or non-alcoholic gin, for instance, or there would be sort of a drink that has its own name, but it's not really clear what it actually is. And then when you drink it kind of just tastes like lemonade that's a little bit too citrusy.
And that will be £19 as well.
Yeah. Yes.
And we charge that much because there's yuzu in it, obviously.
Of course. The yuzu. How could we forget? Oh, and maybe on special occasions, some ube as well.
Ooh. We bring it out the back when we want to get fancy.
And of course, we laugh, guys, we laugh. But these restaurants, they point to a wider problem of cosmopolitan multiculturalism and the gentrification that runs rampant in East London. And we'd argue it's not just cultural sharing, it's not just a fusion restaurant, but it is a disregard for people's culture and their individual cultural identity. And it is, albeit a very hilarious, but it is a case of Orientalism. And these exotic dishes in restaurants owned usually by, again, the whitest people you have ever seen, usually have no link whatsoever to the culture they're sampling from. We know that whoever is serving that horrific vegan sambal-flavored cheesecake has been to Bali maybe once and never again. And it's purely in regards to the aesthetic rather than an actual appreciation from the cultures and the foods that they're sampling from.
I mean, it's something that we might have all seen in the news, say, what is now known as Donny's sandwich shop was originally Donny's Donna's, which was sort of advertised as a neighbourhood kebab shop in London Fields, and it was DJ-owned, but he just had major backlash for the premise of it, the fact that he was trying to use kebab, which is food that is prominent in so many different cultures, with complete disregard, even trying to get it as right as he could, even trying to have any sort of background information, any help from different takes on kebab. You can tell that the original proposal was just so he could call it Donny's Donna's and sort of I don't know, make an entire business based on the fact that people say, oh, I'm just gonna get a cheeky kebab, for instance. But it's something very real, and of course a lot of people were offended by it, which is why now it's just sort of broadened and just changed to Donny's the sandwich shop. And the owner did issue an apology saying that you know, acknowledging that he was very tone deaf in how he did it. But I think it just reflects the wider problem as well. And especially when it comes to the independent businesses, many of which are Bengali and Bangladeshi owned as well. Now take the old Truman Brewery, which all 16 of the food and drink businesses in that brewery are independent. And a lot of them are Bangladeshi or Bengali owned. And there was, for our listeners who aren't familiar, there was a plan to knock the old Truman Brewery down and build office blocks. And there was quite a big petition and a lot of protests against its demolition. In fact, it's still there. But then if you look at what the surrounding businesses are, you can tell that there has still been an erosion of different people's cultural identities.
For sure.
And I think what's so interesting about the Donny's Donna example, and probably what got people up in arms about it, is just would all of those East London creatives be paying those prices for a donor that had come from a Turkish person?
I fear not.
And it's not to say you can't be a white guy with a donor restaurant. I mean, do what your heart wants. It's just, you've got to acknowledge it's weird on some level.
And, I mean, just super tone deaf.
Yeah, absolutely.
Taking what is actually quite a big part of clubbing culture, but what people love for, like, obviously the low prices, the authenticity, the experience you get when you go into a kebab shop and you're treated with amazing hospitality, of course, and this DJ coming in and making a kebab shop, that's what being sold for, like, I guarantee, what, 20 quid.
And guys, we've got an episode coming up about the state of DJing in this country. Don't worry.
Oh, just you wait.
Everyone wants to be a DJ. No one's getting on the floor. And I think that might be a topical transition into the next thing we want to discuss about what is happening in East London.
Again, big caveat or big disclaimer is that we are also big, big victims of this.
We have
had many a cheeky night out in Dalston and other such places, but we must talk about the nightlife that's happening in East London. There are so many places, good places to go out. But again, in our investigation into the gentrification and the transformation that East London is happening, what exactly is the state of these bars and clubs currently? We can say that East London has been, and for a while has been, a queer nightlife haven. But in London, there is a general pattern of queer nightlife deteriorating. Obviously, East London is home to places like Dalston Superstore, but there's a wider and wider trend in central London of queer spaces being pushed out. GAY was shut down this year and being pushed out to the edges of spaces. And there is an interesting point to be made here about how it seems like queer life can take up space. These clubs are allowed to exist and they are quite popular, but just not often in prime real estate. There is bigger, wider rejection of clubbing culture happening post-pandemic. I mean, just outside of queer nightlife, 400 plus clubs have shut down in London. And that means there is a concentration of people and income in commercial clubs, big event nights. And so these third experimental spaces are often being killed, and often at the times they are queer. This year or next year, I believe, March, Corsica.
R.I.P. Corsica.
R.I.P. Corsica.
And I really have thoughts about the case of Corsica, if I can get on my soapbox for a second.
Oh, please do.
And I just want to say to the people from the Shires and other such places who proceeded to move to Elephant and Castle, a place that has also been at the forefront of gentrification.
Absolutely.
Move to Elephant and Castle. Move in next to one of London's most iconic clubs and proceed to complain that there is noise.
Mind you, there are two clubs in Elephant and Castle.
Two clubs. If anything, be grateful you're next to Corsica and not Ministry. That's, let's reframe
especially
the mindset.
Especially Ministry on a Tuesday.
Oh my god.
Guys, sorry for triggering any flashbacks.
Oh my god.
And apologies to anyone who likes the Ministry of Sound student nights.
Well,
I don't think they exist.
I don't think they'll be tuning in here.
I don't think this podcast appeals to them. But it's truly awful. It's the decimation of nightlife in London to accommodate people who want the appearance of being in London and the social cachet of saying they live in London without wanting to acknowledge what living in a city is like. It's like you hear New Yorkers complaining about transplants trying to shut down New York and killing the 24/7 culture. And I'd argue London is suffering from something very similar. We've got the investment bankers who went to Exeter moving to Elephant and Castle and saying that they can't sleep because Corsica's too noisy.
It's ridiculous. But then that means you have this kind of strange dichotomy, if you will, in East London of it being and still being a safe haven for queer nightlife because it's being pushed out to the edges of things. But also this queer life in East London contributing somewhat to the culture transforming there and possibly even the gentrification. I mean, this is just a theory, but sociologist Sharon Zukin has even theorized that LGBTQ plus residents actually boost property prices because we cultivate and gravitate towards creativity. And she has this whole cyclical theory about how Lesbians arrive, they get priced out of other areas and settle into new ones, the gay men follow their lead, and then they build the institutions because they earn the money, and eventually the straight people arrive. So it's this weird thing about how queer people can both be tastemakers and be shut out at the same time,
mm-hmm.
Which is interesting to see because you have such a case for it in Dalston, or in East London in general.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting as well that all of these things do intersect to a degree, because you could talk about perhaps the white higher socioeconomic status queer people pushing out the brown businesses of the area. But then at the same time, is that a justification for not caring when those queer people, those queer tastemakers and artists are then pushed out of the area
mm-hmm.
by people who love the aesthetic of living in Hackney, of living in Dalston, but who don't do anything to materially contribute to the reputation of that area? And if anything, kind of try and make it more like their boring beige living room.
Speaking of the boring beige living room, I think what people sort of also overlook is the very appearance of these newer bars and these mm-hmm. newer clubs, just in general in East London, that if you look at them objectively, are pushing more progressive ideas, especially around nightlife. For example, increasing the number of gender-neutral bathrooms and having quieter rooms and more accessibility. Just a general acknowledgement that you need to have more accessible spaces. And there's also an appreciation of the sober or the sober curious. You've got bigger group settings, not isolated tables, which I think especially post-pandemic is something that a lot of people might appreciate from, because they could sort of regain a sense of community, re-engage with the idea of just socializing and meeting like-minded people, and, you know, in an environment that is generally quite relaxed. And so mm-hmm. even boiling it down to the very look of these bars and clubs, you sort of see that there is, like, just a disregard for how it's reshaping nightlife.
Yeah, you could say that the nightlife in East London therefore seems to be broadly hegemonic idea of the clubber or the live music event audience member. And there seems to be a sort of criteria or certain threshold that people have been meeting or been striving to meet about, you know, what makes this audience member? What's the performative nature that they need to fulfill?
Mm-hmm.
Can you just dance? Can you just turn up to a gig? Is there a social cue or rules and norms that you need to follow?
Do you need to know the DJ?
No. You can only listen to these niche independent artists. Like, what do you mean you haven't heard of insert niche independent artists? We thought of a menu for a fake restaurant and, sorry, an entirely real business proposal, but we failed to come up with
us,
the name.
Please fund us.
A niche independent artist.
So if you have any suggestions for a niche independent artist name.
You are a niche independent artist.
Maybe you are. First thing that came to my mind was Wasabi with a Z.
Wasabi. What type of music would Wasabi make, though? What music kind of characterizes East London?
It'd be like Brazilian funk, but like with a, like, erhu.
And there's a anime soundbite. That's the producer tag.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the complete opposite. Just think R&B, but R&B done really badly.
Oh my god.
Or R&B mixed with a really distinct bass that they then just call jazz R&B. They just shove it. The word jazz has to be there.
To the Berlioz wannabes out there. We see you.
We don't like you. not to devalue anyone's art. If you're creative, that's amazing. Keep doing what you're doing.
We need more creative careers, especially now that there's an entire problem of creative degrees being removed and underfunding of creative industries. We do need more people to be creative, because that's great, you know. We love music. We love art. That's our oov.
That is our oov. And if it's your oov, it should be. you know?
We welcome all oofs.
We do. But we do also welcome critical thinking.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think there is a lack of it in East London, and that is why it is the subject of our podcast today.
If your oof is a bit scrambled, someone does need to tell you.
Mm-hmm. Or you just need to take a deeper reflection onto, well, you say something is your oof, but what does that actually mean? Mm-hmm. Are you able to stand in front of a room of people and just explain this oof to them in an entirely culturally sensitive manner, or just acknowledging every single facet? We need multifaceted oofs.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. I must agree.
And we need oof, I think, that is not, obviously draw inspiration from whoever you like, but we don't need an imitation of someone else's oof, you know?
Be
You're
your
very talented.
Oof. Yes.
Produce your own oof. I will say something we've missed out about East London that you know, I think we can discuss on here. Guys, enough with the zin. Enough with the,
enough,
and they're laughing
the
because they know how serious this
enough.
Is for me
enough.
To be complaining about it on a podcast. Anyone who knows me knows how serious this has to be. Mm-hmm. Enough with the zin. Or actually, you know what? Keep the zin if it keeps you away from the ICOS.
Oh, God.
I was in East London not long ago, and it doesn't smell like tobacco anymore. It doesn't smell like vape anymore, which I'm like fine with all of that. I'm more than fine with all of that. The smell of IQOS, that's where I'm drawing the line. I know you want to look cultured. I know you brought it back from Berlin. Put it
or
down.
Italy.
Mm. Or Italy.
Or Italy even.
Or Germany too. I saw an IQOS vending machine in Frankfurt Airport. Put it down. Put it down. You're all already romanticizing smoking.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to romanticize the ICOS. It's, you know what? I'll say the one thing that hurts an East London creative soul more than anything else. It's not chic.
Oh, oh,
oh.
I must say that I personally am not okay with the vapes as well, guys. Please put them down. If you are,
so that you
if
can pick them up.
No, if you are in a Dawson Club, okay, reject modernity,
embrace
tradition. You should not be puffing on a watermelon ice crystal vape. All right.
And I back this as someone who grew up in London. See, I am now 21 and I am familiar. I am very much familiar with how popular vapes are.
Oh, trust me, yes.
Yeah. I know a lot of you, it felt like the end of the world when Starmer banned disposables. I feared it would be the end of East London, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. The solution was to get on the ICOS.
No. I think we're done.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you need to smoke a cigarette.
Or
like
just
an
not
adult.
Smoke. For
this
our listeners,
yes,
for our listeners
yes.
out there, for listeners, we would just like to say we are not encouraging smoking.
We are not endorsing this
We
behavior.
Are just saying stop romanticizing smoking.
Okay. Yes, because that is such a vital part of the East London creative's identity. If you go onto Sox House Meeting or Real Housewives of Clapton, every other starter pack post has a picture of some pack of European cigarettes that you are smoking performatively. Which I think is a crazy thing to do, is to give yourself lung cancer performatively.
It's just it's such a strange lexicon,
performative
smoking.
Mm-hmm. The smoke goes into your lungs anyways.
Yeah.
At least the rest of us are doing it with intent to kill.
With intent to kill, exactly.
with prayers that it sets in by exam season.
So, if we were to round out East London, guys, our thoughts, shall we go?
Yeah.
Would you like to start?
Yes.
Oh my God. Guys, you know, long live East London. I am a foreigner. I'm not a Londoner. It's a beautiful part of London with an amazing history, wonderful history of creativity, of the beautiful cultures that have populated themselves there. And I think we need to respect it and preserve it a bit more. You know, it hurts my heart to see the local businesses that are shut down in favor of some Nepo Babies, a three-piece vintage clothing store that will be shut within the year. And let's be more conscious of how we engage with East London, I think, is my final message from this podcast. You're not a villain for going there. If you were, I'd be behind bars. But let's be cognizant, perhaps, of what we choose to consume when we're in that area of London.
Love it. Love it. My thoughts, guys. I love a cheeky night out in East London. Dawson Superstore, lovely. Love a bit of tech, love a bit of house. However, must agree that the cultural sensitivity needs to be up and a little bit in East London. But I love creativity, you know. I love being idiosyncratic. I love being niche. I do, despite poking fun at it a lot, this podcast, I love the style. And I do love some of the clubbing culture that we have in East London. And again, I am also not from here. And it's been great diving in and exploring what the area has to offer. But yeah, let's remain sensitive to the cultures that we borrow from. Let's remain sensitive to the places that we are often invading. And other than that, love it. And let's cultivate the oeuvre of East London a little bit more.
See, now this makes my job going last the most difficult one of all. It's difficult Sorry, not Angelica. To just echo what's just been said. But I guess from my perspective, as someone who has grown up in London, and especially in North London, it's, again, there just needs to be a greater sensitivity to how we approach this very rapidly changing environment in East London. And I think, especially considering how diverse East London is, and I'd say London more generally, it's something that is just so, that needs to be treasured in London, I think, just the diversity of so many different cultures and so many opportunities for cultural appreciation, but we are seeing that it's just turning into cultural appropriation more broadly. And I think especially something that we need to consider is the use of social media. As in, we've got this podcast, but we are three LSE law students in third year.
Sorry, hashtag warning.
Sorry.
We did not disclose this at the beginning, all three of us in the Faculty of Law. I'm law and anthropology, though. Do I get a pass?
Okay, no. We're going down together. We're okay. All in the law common room.
You are currently taking property.
Ouch.
That is so law student. But anyways.
I have to, but no. So sorry if that discards everything we've said.
And it might, and it probably should. But yeah. Please continue listening.
See, I think using social media could just be such, it has, I mean, obviously this is a very idealistic perspective to have, but I think because of how quickly information spreads, we can get the right information spreading that could encourage more people to be more conscious of, say, the cultures that they're engaging with. If people have their vegan miso shakshuka with an upcharge of £10 for an egg to realise the inherent problem in that very sentence. And more importantly, to be aware of the broader communities in East London as well. East London's not just the Brick Lane vintage shops or Cafe, what is it, Cafe 1001?
Oh,
this might be too niche for me, Angelica.
Sorry. Or Night Tales Loft, even. It's not just that, but say even Night Tales Loft, it is sandwiched in a residential area. And a lot of people just see Night Tales Loft, but aren't aware of the fact that that is an area that, you know, is already suffering a lot from economic, like, sort of underfunding, essentially. And increasing, and with sort of this gentrification obviously comes increasing rent prices. How much is done to the wider area? Not very much, because again, it is all these sort of private, like, nepo baby owned businesses. And so, yeah, that's essentially just me dragging out what both Farah and Amanda have said and trying to use the I grew up in London statement.
That's very, very valuable good point. Because of that.
Yeah. Question what you spend your money on, guys. Sometimes that viral small plates restaurant on Instagram maybe isn't worth the £50 you're going to spend there for the single person.
maybe it's not worth whoever they kicked out of that converted warehouse.
Sometimes maybe you should just go to a kebab shop instead of a DJ-owned neighborhood kebab.
Kebab establishment.
Exactly.
But
wow, that's East London, guys. That's East London's oeuvre.
That's East London's oeuvre. And thank you so much, Beaver Sound listeners, for being with us to the end. you kind of had to be here because you didn't know we were law students. And we hope we haven't lost you. And we hope you're familiar with our OOV.
Mm-hmm. We hope we haven't lost you for being law students and for comments about niche independent artists and Arsenal fans, especially. Please, to all the niche independent artists and Arsenal
I'm
fans.
One of you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I question your choices in football to support, but I would love to hear your thoughts on the podcast generally. Just ignore the Arsenal comments.
Yes. Ignore the law student of it all.
Yeah. I mean, we hit it pretty well, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe people
hopefully
told it from could tell from the start. But
maybe from the very name of our podcast, the OOV. Yeah. But we promise we are your unserious satirical guide mm-hmm. on very, very real matters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'll hold your hand very gently, very non-law student-y, and we'll guide you through the current cultural zeitgeist.
The zeitgeist. Is having a boyfriend embarrassing for your OOV? Is being a DJ bad for your OOV? Is liking matcha bad for your OOV? We are here to answer your questions.
Oh.
And mm-hmm. we hope you are familiar with our OOV now.
Absolutely.
Or at least as familiar as you can be in episode one.
Yes. Well,
keep watching. No,
I don't want to say bye to them. I don't want to say bye to them. Guys.
Oh, wow. You.
No, we need to give them time to think about that OOV.
Yeah, yes.
Let's for the next episode.
Question. Let's leave you with a question, yes.
Let's leave you guys with a question.
What is your DJ name?
Ooh, should we answer this ourselves as well? Angelica, you guys, not to call her out like this, so that Angelica does.
I have dabbled.
DJ.
Oh. I have dabbled. I have dabbled.
Let's hear the name.
We need to hear it from DJ herself.
Oh, I actually never thought. See, I had a notes app of different names, but then the more people I kept reading them out to, they were like, "Oh, this sounds quite weird." Well, I mean, something that was toyed at the beginning was the fact that just splitting my name in half and just either picking Ange or Lika.
I mean, I like Lika.
Lika in all capital letters.
Yeah.
Thought that was quite DJ-esque. But for the listeners of Beaver Sound, I will not be playing any music. I will not be mixing anything on this podcast. I would become the very problem that we spent the past 40 minutes discussing.
Yes.
I will just stick to going out and listening to other DJs work their magic.
Do you have a DJ named Manda?
The first thing that came to mind, guys, and reserve judgment, okay? This is, I repeat, the first thing that came to mind was Boots McGee. Thoughts?
Wait, this is crazy.
What you doing if I turn up on stage and I go, yo, give it up for Boots McGee?
We need the YouTube air horn sounds in the background.
Vine boom.
This is crazy because I was thinking Casablanca Boots.
Yeah. Okay, guys, tune in for next week when Farah and I are a DJ duo. Thank you very much. This is no longer a podcast. It is a live mixing.
And I will I'll be setting up the nightclub that they're working at.
In Dalston.
I'll be behind the bar. That's what we do. I'll be mixing a really niche drink name.
Oh,
you
amazing,
know.
Amazing.
See, what would be the OOV flavor profile for a drink?
I know you want to make it a lychee martini really badly.
Yes. Maybe. maybe I do. Maybe.
You're welcome to have that.
Anyways, thank you very much for tuning in.
Bye-bye, Beaver
Sound. We'll see you very soon.
It was lovely to hear about your OOV.